Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life.
One of the things that I see now is that universities are confronted with two publics rather than just one. One public is saying, we want victories. We want to see these great athletes on the floor no matter what. Those are the boosters. Those are the people, it seems to me, who really are not serious about the academic enterprise. Then there's the public that's saying, college athletics has become a scandal. No longer does it have our trust. And that public is growing. And it seems to me we're going to have to work out a solution to these two publics over the next few months or years, or we're going to have serious problems on our hands.
Academics and athletics in American universities, this week on Soundings. First, commentary from Paul Hardin, Chancellor of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Following that, I'll talk with Hunter Rollins, President of the University of Iowa. The faculty at UNC Chapel Hill recently declared that the troubled partnership of universities and intercollegiate athletics be resolved or that it be terminated. The deadlock between sports and academics led the faculty at Chapel Hill to endorse a series of 32 recommendations, including freshman ineligibility and academic progress as a primary responsibility of coaches. With commentary on the dilemma of academics and athletics, here is Paul Hardin, Chancellor of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
The Faculty Council of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill recently completed an important discussion of the role of athletics in the academy, and there is understandable interest in what comes next for student athletes. Some observers speculate that not much will come of the faculty recommendations. That pessimistic appraisal was underscored when one North Carolina newspaper got a skeptical response to a poll of various coaches and other officials in the Atlantic Coast Conference. No one should have assumed that our sister institutions around the region or the nation would automatically embrace the recommendations of someone else's faculty. Therefore, no one should have been discouraged that most of the coaches and officials expressed reservations in their responses to the newspaper survey. After all, most of them had not even read the final report of the Faculty Council when the survey was made. My personal conviction is that the national mood favors the kind of non-draconian but significant reforms recommended by the UNC Chapel Hill Faculty Council. Professors at Chapel Hill are out front of all other faculties, I feel, in stating a comprehensive call for reform, but these recommendations are not a forlorn, lonely cry. Let me point out what I see as grounds for optimism. First, the coaches and athletic administrators and other administrators at Chapel Hill have long supported many of the reforms now recommended by the faculty. Second, the Long Range Planning Committee of the ACC presented sweeping reform proposals of its own last spring. The plan now is that the ACC will pursue endorsement of its reform initiatives by other athletic conferences and present them to the NCAA in time for the January 1991 convention. Third, the NCAA itself is in a reform mood. It has recently adopted several concrete steps that were compatible with the faculty recommendations issued at UNC Chapel Hill. Moreover, the 1990 NCAA convention heard a hard-hitting reform speech by Executive Director Richard Schultz, showed new respect for the President's Commission, and gave sympathetic attention to an interim report of an NCAA cost-cutting study committee headed by Commissioner Gene Corrigan of the Atlantic Coast Conference. Fourth, other important voices support reform, including public opinion, the Knight Commission, and the United States Congress. In North Carolina, the President and Board of Governors of the statewide university system, a network whose 16 schools participate in several athletic conferences, solidly support reform. I predict, in fact, that the NCAA will act even more quickly than the 5-year timetable suggested by the UNC Chapel Hill Faculty Council. I also predict that this will occur with the strong support of many coaches and athletic directors across the nation, although surely with strong opposition by others. Those who might tend instinctively to oppose reform should realize that the current movement is being led, with few exceptions, by people who support intercollegiate athletics, not by the strident few who don't. They should realize, too, that the objective is a level playing field with sensible rules, all aimed at the reduction of athletic demands on students and the accompanying assurance that student athletes are educated rather than exploited. I have a long-standing personal commitment to nationwide reform of intercollegiate athletics and to keeping academic values paramount, despite the sometimes ferocious demands of competitive athletic programs. My hope is that other faculties, students, coaches, university administrators, and boosters will join together to achieve soon the kind of reforms which will reduce these demands. In that way, we can promote throughout the nation a program of intercollegiate athletics which is truly a part of, and not antithetical to, a vital and successful educational experience for all students.
Paul Hardin is Chancellor of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Academics and Athletics in American Universities continues. My guest now is Hunter Rollins, president of the University of Iowa. The conversation addresses what one observer describes as the corruption of higher education by the demands of the entertainment business that big-time college and basketball have become. Here is Hunter Rollins.
Well, we love competition, and in fact, I do myself. I played a lot of college sports, and it's something very dear to my heart. But I think we've gone a little too far, and society at large is demanding more and more of this on television, and so we're into a lot of depth now, I think, in our athletic programs, and maybe out of our depth.
All right. Now, you say society is demanding. Give me a short take on the history of how we got to where we are.
Well, I think Americans have found sports to be very much to their liking, and as times have increased, and especially with television exposure, they want more and more sports, and that involves our colleges in many cases because we have superb athletes.
Did you think of yourself as maybe playing on a farm team when you were a basketball player as a college student?
I thought about it, and on occasion, really more in baseball than in basketball, and I had a couple of tryouts, in fact, with Major League Baseball teams and enjoyed it very much, so it was pretty exciting, and for a 17-year-old in particular, it's heady stuff.
Uh-huh.
In my own particular case, I was very much interested in possibly signing a pro baseball contract, but out of high school, in fact.
Uh-huh.
But as soon as I became aware that what they wanted me to do was to forego college, and these were the days of the draft, when there was no system the way there is now, and they were throwing around pretty good bonus money,
yeah.
It was easy to have your head turned. But when I realized that they didn't want me to go to college, they wanted me to start right away in winter baseball and then summer leagues, I said, hold on here. I want to get that college education first.
About a year ago, you had some sharp things to say about a couple of agents. What is their relationship like with the student athletes?
Well, the particular case you're referring to is the trial in Chicago last year of a couple of agents who had represented University of Iowa athletes, football players, in fact, a couple of years before I arrived at the University of Iowa. So I wasn't familiar myself with the details of the particular case. But what came out during the trial was that these agents had signed these athletes before they should have, and while they were still representing the university as amateurs, and therefore this was really beyond the NCAA regulations.
Mm-hmm. So this was a clear violation of the law. This wasn't boosterism gone amok.
No, this was clear violation of NCAA standards, and was admitted as such later on.
Uh-huh. What about the professional sports managers, the people who run the pro baseball teams and football teams? What's their relationship like with the athletes? Do they not talk to them? Do they talk to them through these agents? How's that work?
Well, it works through various means, sometimes legal and sometimes not so legal. But I think the primary concern there is to interest the athlete in a particular team or a particular sport and to see if you can't develop that athlete towards that professional career.
Uh-huh.
And obviously, promises are made and in some cases can't be fulfilled.
Do you think that these professional sports managers, do they encourage these kids at all academically? Is there any kind of talk back and forth on that level? Is it all Jaguars and big houses and fat contracts.
I don't think there's a whole lot of academic encouragement. That has to come from the campus, and if we don't do a good job of that, then no one will.
All right. Now, speaking of the campuses, what about the coaches? I mean, they seem to be dropping right and left here in North Carolina. Just recently, we lost a basketball coach over at North Carolina State, and I think just as important, we lost a chancellor over there. What's going on with the administrators on campus?
Well, I think what's going on now is that college presidents and chancellors are recognizing that they have to take more and more of a role on this issue before the university's values are simply out the window. Mm-hmm. It's a very difficult arena because we've got a large public that's interested in every single move that is made, and it's hard often to go against what is clearly a public desire to have more athletes, better athletes on the teams. But I don't want to put all coaches in the same category. I think there's a large number of coaches who, in fact, have very strong academic values and who insist that their athletes spend a good deal of time in the classroom.
Name a couple for me.
Well, I think Dean Smith down here is clearly one who has had a real record of insisting on strong academic performance. He's a man of very solid values, and he has a reputation as such. Mm-hmm. Our own Tom Davis at the University of Iowa, I think, has also had a very strong record in this area.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, look, we don't need to name names of the bad guys and the villains here, but without naming names, tell me what goes on when a coach just seems to lose control of these situations. How does the whole thing unravel?
Well, I think what primarily happens is due to competition. The coach finds that in order to compete effectively, he's got to have better athletes. That means sometimes going after people who really are not adequately prepared for the particular institution where that coach is employed, and you begin to cut some corners. Mm-hmm. And then when that works for a year or two and you bring in people, then you've got to make sure that they remain eligible even if they're not well prepared for the work they're doing there. And sometimes you've got problems on the campus in the sense that there are people there to try to ensure that these athletes do all right in the classroom, but they often are forced to cut corners as well because these people sometimes simply are not ready for this situation.
Right. Okay, now you're a university president, Hunter Rawlins. Do you know about these things? Does somebody come to you and say, look, there's a kid in this football program who is just, you know, a Neanderthal, and this kid needs to be worked with and worked on. I mean, is this Band-Aids? The rescue occurs too late? What?
No, I think most universities now have pretty effective programs in place, and we don't look upon anybody as a Neanderthal. We try to work with everybody who comes into the campus, and I think that's our responsibility. And there's a strong network, in fact, designed to give adequate academic support to these individuals, and we try to do that in every case.
Mm-hmm. Give me a sense of some of the specifics that you are aiming for, Hunter Rawlins, when we talk about reforming athletics and their relationship to academics.
I'd like to see reform on a very broad front, Wayne. What I think we have to do now is to insist across the country that our conferences begin to participate in a strong reform movement. If we don't do it ourselves within the universities, it's going to be done for us by someone outside. We have the establishment of the Knight Commission in the last few months, and that's begun to hold hearings, and those are quite important. We have a lot of congressional interest right now, and in fact, some of that pressure this past year brought to bear upon the universities led to the establishment of a new rule which will publicize the graduation rates of athletes from different ethnic groups over the past few years.
Mm-hmm. What about requirements for getting these kids into school to begin with, President Rawlins? I mean, shouldn't they, do they abide by the same standards that that other kids, quote-unquote, have to meet? Give me this sense of, it's like German grammar. There's an exception to the exception to the exception.
Well, I think there are a number of exceptions, and we always will have those and should have those in higher education, I think, because we may have a student, for example, who's particularly adept in music but has not done particularly well in some of the other areas in basic liberal arts and sciences. You want to be able to take that very talented individual and take that person through your own curriculum. So we make exceptions for many cases, and in fact, as it turns out, at most institutions the athletes are rather small number of those exceptions when looked at the whole package.
Is it true, in fact, to take the sort of high road or bright side of this whole picture, President Rawlins, is it true, in fact, that the athletes have a better graduation rate than the student body population as a whole?
It varies from one institution to another. In fact, in some institutions, you're quite right. But in other institutions, there's a lamentable record over the years of athletes graduating, and the primary interest seems to have been simply in keeping them eligible for competition.
How would you characterize the education that a kid who comes to the University of Iowa gets? Now, I realize there's an opportunity to be very self-serving in your answer, but what does a kid go through? What kind of drill in terms of language and literature, the liberal arts, being exposed to the things that all the other kids in the student body are having to work with?
Well, we've seen improvements and increases in the requirements that are laid out for students, not only for exit from the institution, so to speak, graduation, but even for entrance. And now the University of Iowa is no exception to the general rule across the country of stepped up requirements, not only in foreign languages, but in math, in English, in social sciences, and in natural sciences. And mm-hmm. I think we're seeing that from state to state across the U.S. So the requirements are going up, not only for entrance, but for graduation. And there's also, I think, much more emphasis upon some kind of core curriculum, or at least a set of very limited electives within the undergraduate curriculum.
Uh-huh. As a classicist, I take it, Hunter Rollins, that you're a believer in the great books.
Well, of course, I'd like to have everyone take Latin and Greek, but I don't think I've got much chance of getting that across. However, I do see increases in requirements, and I think that's a good thing. We've been putting a lot of blame on the high schools over the last 10 or 15 years for the problems that they have. I think the universities have also had problems in undergraduate education, and uh-huh. we have to make improvements.
What about the faculty? How are faculty members reacting? My sense is that you have, it appears to run to two extremes. People who are very passionate about reforming, and then the others who say nuts to it. You know, they're all just a bunch of lunkheads, and let them go off and play their sports. And that's lamentable, is it not?
Well, faculty members are human beings too, after all, and you run the full spectrum on the faculty from one side to the other. But I think faculties are beginning to take more interest in this as they see embarrassing incidents on their campuses, as they see the entire institution's reputation besmirched by some of these incidents. They're beginning to take a much more major role, I think, at a number of institutions. We've seen that certainly in North Carolina recently. We're seeing it in Iowa at Iowa State University, where a faculty committee has recently made some very strong recommendations for changes in the athletic program. I think we'll see it across the country.
Mm-hmm. Let's come to a wonderful word that has been hovering around the conversation here for a while. That's television. You must love it and hate it at the same time, the influence, the impact that it has on academics and athletics.
Well, television gives a great deal of exposure to our institutions, and in some cases that's a good thing. On the other hand, it begins to become the master when these very large contracts begin to drive the way we do our business. And uh-huh. we've recently seen cases where conferences and individual institutions have made major contractual agreements for very large sums of money, and I think that begins to put us into a dangerous situation.
I have here in front of me an editorial that appeared in the New York Times last April by a man named Neil Pilson, who runs CBS Sports. And he says, fortunately, I think the NCAA has the leadership to put the money to proper use, the money that is that the networks pay to the universities. He says, I also think that university presidents now better understand that they are in a business, whether they like it or not. Are you in a business?
Well, of course. We're all in a business because these are multi-million dollar enterprises, and you have to run them as businesses. There's no question about that. But at the same time, it seems to me you have to do the best you can to maintain the values of the academic tradition.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that? I mean, how do you talk specifically to the people that run these programs? Do you give them sort of classics pep talks about the great books and education and all, or what?
No. In our particular case, we have two superb athletic directors, Bump Elliott and Christine Grant, and they're known nationally. I think not only for their integrity, but for their leadership of our athletic programs. And in fact, they're two of the strongest supporters of our academic program on the campus at the university because they're listened to by a wide public. Mm-hmm. They have a real history in this area and a glorious history, in fact. A couple of years ago, Bump Elliott was able to take a large sum of money, about $500,000, and devote that to the university. It went to the libraries and to our minority recruitment program. Mm-hmm. And that's an example of how athletics can contribute to the good of the institution as a whole. Mm-hmm. I might say, however, it's a fairly rare example because most athletic programs are in the red, and in fact, the money's going the other way from the general fund into the athletic program. We happen to be fortunate in Iowa.
Yeah, I remember I taught for 2 years at the University of Alabama, and I remember when I got there, Coach Bryant personally donated $1 million to the campus. That I take it as a rare exception. Hunter Rollins, I have in front of me another editorial here. This one also last April in the Wall Street Journal. Hauden Carter, who is teaching over at Duke, a neighbor of the Humanities Center, said that oxymoron, that's the word that we should apply to student athletes. Do you feel that strongly about it?
Well, I read that column, and there's a lot of interesting material in it. I don't feel that strongly about it because I think there are a lot of student athletes who are indeed just that, students and athletes. And I think it's unfair to paint them all with the same brush. I think there are a number of them who are very fine students, in fact, student leaders in many cases, have excellent grade point averages, and are students in the fullest sense of the word. But I think it's clear that across the country now, at a number of institutions, there are individuals on the campus who really are not interested in being students at all.
Uh-huh. One of the groups that we haven't talked about here is the parents. How do they react? How do you talk to the parents of these student athletes? Do they come to you with trepidation or dollar signs in their eyes?
No, I find the parents are a very fine influence, and the more we can talk with the parents of student athletes, the better off we are. I've met with some very interesting parents just recently, in fact, at our campus, who have a history of sending their sons to us to play football, and their sons have performed extremely well in the classroom. These parents are a very fine example of what the program should be about.
Mm-hmm. One report that came out at the University of North Carolina went so far as to say that if reform is not possible unilaterally or in collaboration with other universities, that the faculty at Chapel Hill should consider just saying, to heck with it, we should pull out of the Atlantic Coast Conference. Would you take a step as drastic as that at the University of Iowa?
That's a pretty drastic step, and I doubt that any of us is prepared to do that. But I did read that report, and it's a very fine report. It's written exceptionally well by a faculty group that obviously feels strongly about its concerns. And in fact, that group went so far as to say that the exceptional degree of public distrust and discontent with intercollegiate athletics shown recently in polls and in the press reflects a growing sense inside and outside the universities that intercollegiate sports programs are out of proportion to their functional place in the academic world. Now, that's a faculty group speaking. They're obviously concerned about which direction we're headed in, and that's at an institution which, after all, has run its programs with a great deal of integrity over the years.
I still don't really get a sense of the answer here. Would you go that far as to pulling out of the conference?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think we'd be prepared to do that. We think we can manage the program far better than that. And I think the faculty group at North Carolina feels the same way. But they're growing more and more frustrated with the slow process of reform. And I think that's happened to a lot of us. We feel as though at the NCAA it's been very, very difficult to get meaningful reform. Now, I do sense a change this year. Frankly, I sense much more momentum than before.
What, amongst the university presidents?
Among the university presidents, among conference commissioners, and that brings me to a report that's just been completed among the major conference commissioners, which calls for reform broadly in a number of areas, particularly in cost-cutting, on the academic side of things, and in some other areas of the academic athletic enterprise that I think are very important. My guess is, frankly, that the NCAA convention in January of 1991 is going to see some very major reforms passed.
Uh-huh.
We saw some change this past January. The presidents, I think, began to reassert their own control over the situation, and with the public attention given to a number of recent scandals, I think there's even more momentum being gained now. So I expect to see real change this time around.
What about the booster clubs, Hunter Rollins? Are these good guys or bad guys? Do you get along with them pretty well up in Iowa?
Well, they're like everybody else. They vary from person to person. A number of our own athletic friends and supporters at the University of Iowa don't like the term boosters. They think that's demeaning. A number of them, in fact, are loyal supporters of the university at large.
Well, I don't care what you call them. If they're doing something that isn't exerting an influence that isn't proper on the student athletes.
But then that has to be shown, and I think in some cases it can be shown, and in other cases it cannot. I just attended a very fine meeting in Des Moines, Iowa, the capital of Iowa, where local supporters of our athletic program gave a dinner in which they introduced our graduating athletes to the leaders of business and industry in the state of Iowa, mm-hmm. with the hopes that there would be some good connections made towards future jobs. Now that, it seems to me, is exactly the kind of thing you want your alumni and your supporters to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, President Rollins. Again, I'll press you for some specifics. We want to eliminate freshman eligibility. What other the steps, concrete steps, need to happen over the next 5-10 years to clean up the student-athlete picture?
The first thing, it seems to me, is we need to address initial eligibility. I think there's been a real concern with that. The passage of Proposition 48 caused a lot of anxiety, and it seems to me it also involves a misuse of standardized tests, as the test makers themselves will tell you. I think what we have to do is instead impose a new eligibility requirement, which will create a balance between tests and performance in class in high school. The commissioners, in their report that I referred to a few minutes ago, have proposed exactly that kind of step, which would be a combination of SAT or ACT scores on the one hand, and then scores in core courses in high school. Mm-hmm. That, it seems to me, is a sensible approach. It does not have the racial overtones that Proposition 48 and 42 had, and as a result, I think it makes a great deal of sense. In addition, it seems to me we've got to have some quality standards set for continuing participation. The Big Ten's been trying to get other conferences to agree to this for a number of years. I think now we're beginning to see the start of something that would say each year the student athlete must maintain a certain grade point average in order to stay eligible, not just get D's and slip by, but achieve a decent score that will lead one to believe that that athlete is making his or her way towards graduation.
All right, a footnote to our conversation, Hunter Rollins. Are you, after all, optimistic about what's how this whole scenario is going to play itself out, the students and the athletes and the universities?
I'm a perennial optimist because it seems to me you don't gain anything by being a pessimist. So I tend to be on the optimistic side. I'm relatively new to this business, so maybe there's a bit of naivete in there as well, but I don't mind that either. I'd like to see change, and I don't feel like being defensive any longer about the way these programs are being run. I feel like changing them, and I think we're seeing that momentum grow now.
Hunter Rollins is the president of the University of Iowa. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Academics and Athletics is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. Please ask for program number 521. That's program number 521. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, Mother Tongues and Mother Love. Listen for conversations with Angelica Bommer of Emory University and Nancy Shepherd Hughes of the University of California at Berkeley. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. This week brings the anniversary of Richard Nixon's 1952 Checkers speech. The then vice president reacted to charges of illegal political contributions. He also vowed not to return Checkers, a cocker spaniel given as a gift to his daughters. 56 years ago this week, Babe Ruth played his last game for the New York Yankees. Birthdays during late September include the cartoonist Al Capp, the TV executive William Paley, the first American female presidential candidate Victoria Woodhull, the singer Ray Charles, the poet T.S. Eliot, the composer George Gershwin, the writers F. Scott Fitzgerald and Walter Lippmann, and the educator William McGuffey. This week marks an anniversary for the discovery of the planet Neptune, which was first observed in September 1846, and for the establishment, in 1829, of Scotland Yard. The official name of Scotland Yard is the Greater London Metropolitan Police. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Academics and Athletics, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Paul Hardin, Chancellor of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, offers commentary on student athletes. Hunter Rollins, President of the University of Iowa, discusses the troubled partnership between universities and intercollegiate athletics. Academics and Athletics, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.